Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I'm thrilled because, once again, my friend, my good friend who lives in paradise in Hawaii, Brad Coates, is my guest. And we'll talk about his book, and specifically what we're going to talk about today is how romantic relationship issues evolve at life's different stages. And we're going to especially focus in on millennials and some on the aging baby boomers. Welcome back to the show, Brad.
Well, good to be back, Diana, and aloha, everybody.
Yes. How are things in Hawaii?
Beautiful, as always.
Right.
Wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. You made a choice to live in Hawaii.
Got a volcano going off over here, but other than that, it's perfect.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. That's been quite a long time now, and it must
be going on two, maybe even 3 months, and it's upending the Big Island, yeah.
Right. It's got to be very chaotic and awful for the Big Island residents.
It's certainly watching nature form a new topography, that's for sure. And we can talk today about how people form new relationships or don't.
Yeah, we're going to do that. Brad Coates heads up the biggest divorce law firm in Hawaii. And his book now in its fourth edition, or maybe it's five now?
Five now.
I'm holding in my hand the fourth edition, but the Divorce with Decency is the title. The subtitle is The Complete How-To Handbook and Surveyor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. And so we have in his fifth edition also information about Can Your Marriage Be Saved and Love in the Internet Age. We're going to look at the latter to a degree here, love in the Internet Age. You always like your statistics, and they are great because it sets the scene. I thought we'd start. Did you get my last-minute email, by the way?
I did.
Okay, terrific. So we're going to focus on millennials and some of their dating habits because that's fascinating. And perhaps we'll get to the boomers and the gray divorce, which is mostly sad. So the millennials. What about the millennials? Well, you describe them because they're
Just under 90 million of them.
Yeah.
They call them Generation Y, and it's roughly those folks who were born between 1980 and 1995. So now it's people that are, 23, 24 to maybe 38 years old. Mm-hmm. And, it's a pretty big contingent of people, throughout American society. And it's interesting to watch, what's basically become a mindset for them sort of in general. I mean, everybody's talked about how they've had a bleak economic future, set of reversals, that they haven't done what used to be the building blocks of an American, the milestones of American life, where you get married, you have kids, you buy a house. That, the economists call that household formation, and that's kind of what has driven America's economy and society for a long time. And a lot of these kids, sometimes through no fault of their own, are not in any position to do any of this. So it's translated. Your show focuses mainly on how it affects people in their romantic relationships and maybe sexuality. And what it's done apparently is that it's put a lot of these people in kind of a tentative mindset about life in general. They they're still living in their parents' houses. They're not courting the way certainly we used to court. I mean, I remember buying a corsage and having my parents drive me to the 10th grade dance and pick up a girl who had, an elegant dress on, and I'd had to call her a month in advance to organize it and, hope she would say yes and face the fear of rejection if she said no. And instead, You know, a lot of these people can't afford to go out for lavish dinners or lavish dates, for one thing. Mm-hmm. So economically, they've throttled back. And then because they're all doing everything through cell phones, they, you know, that whole face-to-face interaction that we used to think of as courtship is kind of passe.
Well, the devices in the IT generation, we'll get a little bit more into that as we go because it seems to have changed everything. So that's a pretty good overview of the millennials, and then you get into dating habits, and of course, I was particularly fascinated in your outline about the new monogamy, and sometimes this is called monogamish. I guess you've heard that term.
I like that term. Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually. Thank you, Dan Savage, who is a Seattle person and is an editor of a local, The Stranger, a local newspaper. But
is he in Seattle now? Have you ever run into him? He's an interesting guy.
Yes, he is. Yes, I have. And anyway, but he has a nationally syndicated column. So he's a popular sex columnist. But what he talks about is monogamish, and this is negotiated monogamy. And it seems like there are a growing number of couples, I guess especially millennials, who are reconsidering the terms of their commitment. And you talk about this too, the hyper-casual approach to dating. Say a little more about that.
Well, it's kind of what I was, you know, comparing and contrasting earlier. In the old days, whenever we were growing up, really had to sort of put yourself out on a line. You'd have to literally call a girl like on purpose, not just pretend that you were running into her by accident just because you happen to be. Nowadays, it's like, hey, me and a bunch of the guys are going to be at Joe's Bar tonight. You know, why don't you and some of your gal friends come on down? And it's like, is that a date for, is he calling me? Is he calling my girlfriend? Is he asking me or is he wanting me to meet one of his friends? I mean, you know, it's all kind of lost in the haze a little bit. And there's nothing really even remotely committed to it. And of course, these people grew up, bear in mind that they were they're the children of a lot of our baby boom generation. A lot of them have grown up with parents that have been divorced. A lot of them have grown up with, a lot of the parents who were in the sexual liberation generation of the 60s following the birth control pill. And, you know, a lot of our generation kind of, you know, got a little freewheeling. And so they've taken a lot of that freewheeling stuff, and have adopted that, but they haven't. You know, we ultimately, or at least a lot of us, then ultimately settled down and did give the monogamy thing a shot and kept real jobs and real houses and raised kids and all that stuff. And the millennials, they're apparently 20% less likely to be having kids, you know, much less likely to be owning homes. And they just, you know, it's a very non-committed kind of a thing. So it is, when it comes to dating, it's a very hyper-casual sort of a thing where it's just like, you know, hey, let's hang. And you're not really even sure where it heads. And even when they start, you know, having sexual relationships, you're not even really sure where that heads either, because a lot of this is sort of, you know, based upon, you know, almost the hookup culture rather than a, you know, hey, I want you to be my girlfriend. And maybe after 6 months of being my girlfriend, maybe we can have sex, which is, you know. Yeah, I don't know if I was the only guy that was held off for 6 months, but I think a lot of us were in those days. And now it's like, you know, now it's like, let's have sex right now. But then, you know, then they have a hard time following up with the commitment that comes later.
That's right. And you write very correctly. Hookups may be a way of hedging one's bets and keeping the options open. They allow for physical pleasure while avoiding emotional risks. And that's very true. I wanted to go back to the monogamous thing because it is prevalent among millennials. And you probably, well, we've talked on previous shows because Brad is a regular guest of mine and longtime friend for almost 20 years now, one year short. 20 years when I used to live in Hawaii, and Brad was on my show there when his book, Divorce with Decency, first came out in 1999.
Am I right? Over to the mainland.
Yes, yes. Some experts, like psychologist Christopher Ryan, Dr. Christopher Ryan, he's the co-author of Sex at Dawn. He goes as far as to argue that monogamy fundamentally goes against the programming in our DNA, that our ancestral tribes shared not only food and shelter, but also sex partners. So he is in favor of couples, and I've certainly had clients discuss this, but they have to discuss it well to make it work, because there are usually consequences, like enduring resentment or even falling in love with somebody else. That would be a worry if the relationship is opened. One person might worry. And I think it also fails when one person is the driver and the other person feels pressured to agree. And it's often the man driving it and the woman going along because she's pressured. And it also is a very difficult thing if the decision is made out of anger or resentment. And then, of course, that tends to not work either. Big shock. So the negotiating monogamish is pretty important, and sometimes I help some of my clients in session do that because they have decided they'd like to try to do this negotiated monogamy. And do you have any clients who come in for a divorce having tried that and it's failed?
Well, I certainly have plenty of clients that come in and are coming into me as a divorce lawyer because their marriage has fallen apart because of outside sex. I don't know how many people, even though I agree with you that it seems like to me, given everything we know about human knowledge, biology, and human history, monogamy is really, it's almost like about a 75-year-old concept that came. It's almost been just in post-war, just in the Western world.
Yeah.
And now it's treated as gospel, of course. But it is a tough it's a tough road to hoe. And I don't know that too many people are able to discuss the new monogamy, monogamish, polyamory, where there's a willingness to openly acknowledge that a long-standing relationship might not meet each partner's, physical and emotional needs at all time, and that going outside of a relationship for sex doesn't mean, forfeiting the main relationship. All of that makes perfect sense if you're discussing it, with a sex therapist or a divorce lawyer who's handled, literally hundreds of divorces where, sex has been the big issue in causing the divorce. I know it, you know it, we all know that it's a real phenomenon, but trying to explain that to your spouse and getting them to agree to it is tricky. And I don't know that too many people would even have the nerve to try. I think what happens is people just start implementing it without actually discussing it. And that's where you're exactly right. If it hasn't been, negotiated in a fairly open fashion, then it's going to seem, sneaky and philandering and whatever. And that's going to cause a whole new set of resentments. And
exactly.
Yet trying to negotiate something like that in a forthright manner, that ain't easy either.
It isn't, because I think part of that discussion has to include that both partners come clean about what they feel emotionally capable of handling. And that sometimes requires a professional in the room to kind of guide that conversation, because it's so tricky.
How about you? Have you had some success with that?
Personally?
No, I mean, with your clients. Or personally,
yes.
Either way.
Yeah, well, I discuss my personal life some on the air, but, and as you know, because actually you and my now husband, Brian, were we all did a show together last February. That was kind of fun. Yes, I've had these discussions with clients, and I had I have one couple that I've been seeing since last fall, and it's a different scenario because typically it's more the man who wants it, but in this case she wants it, and her husband's very introverted and shy, and she's the opposite. And she says, you know, I don't think I want to, I don't want to die and not have had some sex with somebody else, but negotiated. And I don't think that's going to happen because he's so not in favor of it. So, but at least they're talking, they're getting it out on the table, so to speak.
Well, my guess is that most of these millennials are not engaging in a real, you know, maybe they have an intuitive understanding of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, Rolling Stone did an mm-hmm. article called Tales from the Millennial Sexual Revolution, where they, you know, that was their contention, is that millennials do now embrace this whole new monogamy thing. And the question is, are they embracing it openly, or are they just kind of adapting to it, you know, as far as their own personal code? I think probably you know that a lot of this is sort of left unsaid, but it's not unfelt, and mm-hmm. it's probably why the millennials are less likely to have you know, marriages or kids or, you know, or anything concrete, because everything's a little squishy. And part of what's making everything so squishy is what you said. It's IT. The fact that, you know, the millennials were really kind of one of the first generations that was raised on you know, with IT as in you know, almost, so they might as well have implanted computer chips into some of these kids because they're so you know, they're so wedded to their phones.
Yes.
You know, the one behind them, the generation behind them, they call Generation Z, and they are totally digital natives. So, you know, this is definitely, you know, sort of imbued in them. But like I say, at the same time as they may be getting all this information, there's all kinds of studies that are indicating that they're less able to communicate with anybody in person on serious levels. I mean, that's the whole flip side of how wonderful smartphones are making everything to have wealth of information come at you, and you can be like a sponge picking it all up. But the question is, you know, are you learning to communicate, you know, any better, you know, face to face with real human beings? I mean, you know, everybody talks about the, you know, the dinner table conversations where, you know, you've got these young kids that are, you know, you're trying to get them out of their smartphones to even carry on a face to face conversation at dinner. And then that's, you know, it's like real communication skills are being lost amidst this avalanche of communication. It's kind of weird.
It is weird, and a big part that's going by the wayside when people are feeling less connected to a face-to-face partner is that they avoid self-disclosure. And that's a big part of true intimacy, a couple getting, you know, emotional intimacy, and which would lead to better physical intimacy, in my experience, but less self-disclosure.
I like your term, avoiding self-disclosure, because that's exactly right. They, you know, they may have all kinds of information about everything else going on in the world, but they're maybe a little more circumspect about disclosing stuff themselves.
That's right, and smartphones also fragment human consciousness. I think the lower the quality of conversation in the presence of smartphones, and this has been observed many times in research, and the diminished empathy come about through the habitual use of the devices. Habitual use. It fragments human consciousness. And they talk about absent presence, the ability of a partner to be physically present but absorbed by a world elsewhere. And that would be absent presence.
I like that term, too.
Yeah. Well, that term was brought about back in 2002 by a Swarthmore College psychologist named Kenneth Gergen. And then that was even before smartphones multiplied the power of the mobile phones to remove us from the presence of somebody else. Now it's just being the expectation of constant availability to everyone in our social network, and so that speaks to what you write about the paradox of choice. We have so many choices. Yeah.
Well, that is, one of the next stages. I mean, you know, I don't just to sort of bring your listeners up to speed on what you know what Diana's referring to as the paradox of choice is. It really revolves around a situation, and again, a lot of it has to do with computers and smartphones, that creates, you know, innumerable options available to everybody. But what this Swarthmore professor has come up with, he says that people who actually have so many options are oftentimes less satisfied, which would seem to be a paradox, hence the term paradox of choice. You know, the implication being that having so many too many choices can actually become sort of terrifying, and people find it difficult to settle down with any one person, because around every corner there's more choices, more potential opportunities, and leading to have everybody explore as many options as they can because they can. I mean, it's a far cry from the good old days where, you know, in middle America, you met a hometown gal and she was the cutest thing you'd ever seen because there were only, you know, 10 other girls in her class. And, you know, so, okay, I guess I'm going to marry her because she was my high school sweetheart. And now there's thousands of other girls every time you pick up your phone and hit the Tinder app. So, you know, how do you decide on anyone, anything when everything seems to be, almost inundated by further choices. So
it is weird that it's that some of these folks settled for, in the past, the boomer past maybe, companionate love, that you married the first person you meet, and somebody that you could possibly start a family with, and so. But that's not true anymore. And I think a lot of people say, oh, well, there'll be somebody else coming around the corner any minute now.
Well, there is somebody else coming around the corner. I mean, there's several somebody else's literally coming around the corner.
That's right.
So that's a whole different deal, thinking, oh, my God, if I, you know, the previous approach was, if I let him or her get away, will I ever find anybody as wonderful as they were? And so you jumped into the... You jumped into the pool. You drank the Kool-Aid. You got married. You did what did what you were expected to do. And nowadays, of course, you know full well that there's 10 more choices just by swiping right or swiping left, available to you. And you know, so why settle on the first one, or why settle on anyone? So that's going to be the potential problem for some of these millennials is. You know, how are they ever going to settle on much of anything, or are they just going to kind of be, you know, open-ended in virtually every aspect of all their relationships? I mean, you see it in, you know, I don't know if you've tried to hire any millennials lately, but we have to in my law firm, and
yes.
You know, the devotion to a career, to one employer, to anything remotely resembling that is, you know, non-existent. It's you know. Job jumping is consistent, and partner jumping is consistent. You know, it's really become a brave new world of things moving along rather rapidly, and no need to commit to anyone, anything.
It's very true. You know, I in the block where I live is this fabulous French bakery that was started about 4 years ago by people who came over from Paris, and it's just great. And I've gotten to know the female owner some, And she has such a turnover of people that work in her bakery as a cashiering and serving the meals. She said she can't keep anybody. Now, these might even be younger than millennials. Probably they are. But, there's just freest. They just roam around. So maybe these are more like your Generation X's or even Generation Z. Generation Z.
It's kind of interesting. The Z generation, which comes behind them, are are potentially more conservative. They call the Z generation. There's about 60 million Zers, and those are the ones born from around 1995. And these are squishy numbers, but they like to put them in general category.
Right.
1995 to 2005, mm-hmm. And the sociologists seem to feel that the Zs are going to differ from the millennials. The millennials, again, tend to minimize their desire for outright ownership of anything, whether it's a car or a retirement plan from sticking with one job or a house or anything else. And they prefer to stay nomadic and flexible. Conversely, two-thirds of all Generation Zers say they want to own houses, they want to own cars. They may be getting to be more conservative, almost like their grandparents out of the silent generation. So it is interesting to watch these generations swing back from one to the next. And supposedly the Zers have got a little more stability and a little more conservative values. So,
explain, Brad, how do you explain that? I have an explanation, but I don't want to hear from you. How, say, the Generation Zers are more conservative after.
Well, what's this? And again, I'm a divorce lawyer. I'm not a real sociologist, but I've studied a lot of it from trying to write my books. And what happened apparently with the millennials, backing up to them, they were raised actually in kind of a benign time. That was basically a period where you had them coming of age in the 80s and 90s and early 90s, which was a pretty good period. You remember the 80s. The 80s were the Reagan era, the decade of greed is good, the Wall Street era. It was a lot of people made a lot of money, snorted a lot of cocaine, had a lot of sex in and outside of marriage, it was a pretty wild time. Then you had Bill Clinton, who was kind of the opposite of Reagan, and he was having sex in the White House, for Christ's sake. So you got, mm-hmm. it was a pretty freewheeling time. And yet, because America was still the big dog on the block in the post-war context, the economy was good, people got jobs, things were pretty happy-go-lucky. And then all of a sudden, the Great Recession hits, and the Twin Towers come down in the year 2001, 2007, and all of a sudden the millennials get whacked. They're the worst hit by the economics that were raised during that time. So they were raised during the benign boom times, the peace of the 1980s and 1990s, and then all of a sudden they see their sunny world dashed. So what the sociologists refer to that is, kind of a story of innocence lost. So, they had to, they were just kind of whacked. Maybe they were a little pampered. Maybe they were a little shocked to see their world come undone. And it maybe rattled their willingness to bet on any future. Whereas the Z generation, they've had their eyes wide open from the very beginning. If you look at the birth of the Z generation in the early 90s to the mid 2000s, they've had issues from the beginning. I mean, they saw the recession, they saw jobs being hard to get, they saw that a lot of this kind of stuff that were the factors that define the conservative characteristic of our parents. You got a recession, you got jobs, you can't take risk, they've got a whole different outlook that was formed by having been whacked by some bad times that caused them to get more serious faster, much like the generation that came out of World War II. My dad came home from World War II and all of his buddies, And they were, you know, they were lucky to be alive. I mean, they'd all fought in the war. They'd all seen a bunch of their friends get killed. They, you know, they life was serious, and it was serious for them at age 18. You know, my dad went into the Air Force at age 18, immediately joined during the war, and you know, it literally was formative for him. They're forever after. And, you know, they all came home. They wanted to buy a house. They wanted to get a job. They wanted to raise a family. They wanted to, you know, have a backyard barbecue, maybe a swimming pool if they were really rich, live in the suburbs. And, that was their whole goal in life.
That was their dream, the American dream.
And the millennials grew up as their kids, having a pretty good go of it, too. And then the Gen Z came along, and they grew up right during the middle of the recession and watching their parents lose everything they had. And all of a sudden they go, holy shit, maybe this is serious. So they've apparently got, I mean, like I say, I'm undoubtedly being way, way over broad here. But it is it ingrained a set of habits in these two different generations that made them quite different, even though they're kind of adjoining.
Yeah, it's And it's looking at the previous generation and seeing, and so it seems to be a pattern that one generation is a little more conservative, following of really acting out previous generations.
And you said they always say that one generation reacts counteracts the prior generation. You said that you had some ideas on the millennials and the Z generation too from your practice.
Yeah, well, and I've already talked about some of them. One that's really true for lots of millennials, because I tend to see millennials, if they're younger people, I see millennials. And then if they're older, then the boomers. But so the question of pornography, which you discuss in your book, that reflects millennials pretty well, because about 90% of young men report using pornography with some regularity, and it could even be higher than when I last read this now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't even know who the other 10% might be.
Yeah, maybe so. And about 34% of young women. It's often like Dr. Marty Klein, a colleague and friend of mine, he wrote a book called His Porn, Her Pain. Pornography is can be a scapegoat for all the conversations couples aren't having. A big part of my work is to help them start to communicate, especially about their sexual and desires. And it, you know, turns out that men and women have very different sexual tastes, many men and women, different sexual preferences, sexual interests, sexual fantasies, and they may be aroused by different things and prefer different kinds of sexual stimulation. So all of this, I think, needs to be discussed, because porn is not about a relationship. It's about, for many men, about the freedom to be self-centered. But maybe before we get more into that and some of the upsides and downsides of pornography, you write, what do you write in your book about porn?
It's
huge. Numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's staggering. It's staggering how widespread pornography is nowadays, and it's just, you know, it is totally changing. It's totally changing the nature of you know, human of romantic relationships. No question about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's made, you know, it's like you say, it's made men more self-centered. It's totally upended the expectations sometime of what, you know. I mean, if you're watching on your phone, you know, a 20-year-old girl in lace stockings and stiletto heels and, you know, and implanted bosoms and, you know, performing oral sex acts, then you come home to your 54-year-old wife who's, you know, 20 pounds overweight and, you know, And, you know, you can't even discuss oral sex with her without her just, you know, sort of cringing. You're right. It makes men more self-centered. It's turned guys into almost automatons in some ways. I mean, the Japanese are the classic example. They are literally right on the verge of having robotic sex dolls. I mean, within probably the next 5 years, you're going to be able to make love to a robot.
Fascinating. But kind of sad, too. Apparently in Japan, they don't have a lot of new marriages, and the birth rate is way down.
Birth rate in the U.S. is way down. I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to have some unintended consequences.
Yeah. When I said it makes men self-centered, there's a plus to that, too, in that he can say, porn is for me. It's a way that I can relax. Porn never says no, and it carries no opportunity for rejection. So it can be a way for a man to relax, and this is what's so interesting to me, and I've certainly heard this in my practice, that one of the main reasons a man can get an erection more easily with porn than with a partner is that he doesn't have to focus on her needs. You have to relax in order to get an erection. And so so I often ask if a guy comes in with erectile dysfunction or premature ejaculation, I'll ask him about his porn viewing habits. And if his wife is there, sometimes they haven't had this discussion. But anyway, I come to find out, he watches it, and he does not have ED or PE, premature ejaculation, when he's watching porn. Now, there's some downsides, too, but I just wanted to focus on some of the upsides, because I think by itself, porn use does not negatively affect a couple relationships. It's only when one person does it in secret. And you touched on that earlier, Brad. When it's done in secret, I have found that couples who come in and they present, well, porn is a problem, and yes, the husband had been doing it in secret, so it's often linked to relationship dissatisfaction, especially if the wife sees it as degrading, that porn is degrading, that that it drives them to secrecy and the couple to conflict. So that's what I've seen. But I want to talk about the millennials after you comment, because it's a little different among some millennials. Couples watching porn.
Well, it's gotten even more prevalent, apparently. The reality of it is now, it used to be that, porn as we knew it was, you went to a video store and you surreptitiously got a VCR tape and put it in a brown paper bag and walked out and maybe watched it when you got a chance. Now it's, there's thousands of sex acts going on everybody's smartphones. And you can do it much more surreptitiously. You can do it much more often. It certainly, the statistics I said, that I got was that the average smartphone user will view an average of 348 porn videos this year alone, which is basically one a day, right? Or almost one a day.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And depending on what you're doing when you're watching porn, I suppose you can just, sit there and watch it. But if you're watching it and exercising, masturbation at the same time, and you can only, a guy can only have so many erections and so many orgasms, at least this guy can only have so many, speaking personally, but I think most guys, you've only got so much left after, if you're expending it there, you're not expending it with your spouse. So that right there creates a dynamic problem. The other problem is that men who watch too much porn can run the risk of losing their ability to perform in real life
because
again, you've got this entire sense of everything being so perfect in porn, and then when it's less perfect, you don't know how to handle it. So I mean, just quantitatively, if you're spending more time with porn, you got a less time with your spouse, you got a problem. And then qualitatively, mentally, if you're focused on you know, porn rather than reality, you know, then the reality may look a little bleak by comparison or plain by comparison.
Yes, and that's why I say porn is fantasy. It's not sex education. It's all fantasy, but it can help certain couples. Now, these are the millennials. These that tend to be the millennials. I've heard from some younger women who are generally 35 and younger, maybe, well, 38 would be at the far end of the millennial, right?
I think so, yeah.
Born in 1980. When females do watch porn, with or without their partners, couples do well. And the reason is, and I've seen some of these people, they come in with other problems other than porn, but female porn use has benefits because it's a proxy for bringing partners' sexual expectations together. You know, they've never had that conversation about what their expectations are and what do they want and what do they need. And so couples who view pornography together as partners find it easier to discuss their sexual desires and fantasies. And once again, we're back to communication is key. It's just key. What they like, what turns them on, the fantasies they harbor. And even having a conversation early on in the relationship, not first date, of course, what is the role of pornography in our relationship? What is the role? Let's talk about it.
Well, that, you know, I can tell you as a divorce lawyer that,
yes.
I can tell you a couple things.
Yes.
For women in divorce, this is to follow your point about communication. For women
right.
getting divorced, when I hear from a lady coming in wanting a divorce, it's a lot of the time, most of the time, it has to do with insufficient communication with their spouse. They just,
yes.
the women have evolved to a different plane, and the guys maybe have not kept up, or guys are just not as compulsive of communicators to begin with. And, you know, women get upset about that and bail.
Mm-hmm.
If a guy's coming in for a divorce, you know, 75% of the time it's because he's got a new wahine, which is Hawaiian for woman, in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, I had one client come in and say, hey, my wife is not my intellectual equal, which I guess has to do with communication. I mean, I could count on one hand the number of guys that have come in and said, you know, I don't feel there's enough communication in my marriage. I could count
right.
on, you know, it takes dozens of hands to count the number of guys who are leaving their marriages for another woman. So the communication issue is a very female thing. Females file for 2/3 of all divorces, you know, not only in Hawaii, but nationwide. So it's really, guys, if you haven't figured it out, you know, keeping the wahines happy is a real important aspect of marriage. So then we go back to tie it in with what we're talking about with the millennials, who are great at absorbing information and knowing where to find the right four Yelp review, Thai food restaurant. But and they can, they're like sieves as far as soaking up information, but they've lost verbal communication skills along the way.
Yes.
And then you tie that in with how that's going to upset the wahinis. And then the other thing that I mentioned in the outline I sent to you and we haven't covered yet is like the ultimate extrapolation of this is this new thing that I did, you know, I didn't even realize this was a thing, but I'm 67, so what do I know? But this ghosting where now...
Yes, you're right about that.
Now, not only do the millennials avoid serious relationships in general, but then when they want to end one, they don't even end it with any class or a sense of viable communication. They just stop texting, and you have to guess what went wrong in the relationship. You know, they ignore their former partner's attempts to reach out through social media, or and they basically, what that leads to is people not holding themselves accountable anymore because they can hide behind their smartphones. And that, yes. I mean, you talk about lack of communication. That's like the ultimate lack of communication. I'm just not, you know, I'm not going to communicate at all. I mean, at least if you're going to break up a relationship, have the decency to tell somebody you're breaking up with them. Don't just make them guess. You know, does he hate my guts or did his battery just run down?
Yes. You know, it's terrible for the person who's been ghosted. Because there's no closure, and they will often, if it's a woman, and it often is, right? So if it's a woman, she already maybe has anxiety about her ability to be in relationships, and this would confirm it, but also make it even worse for her.
I was shocked to find out how commonplace this is, and yet when I talk to some of my younger friends and clients, that's no joke. I mean, a lot of these relationships are Tinder-style relationships that start up, you know, just with one or two texts, and, you know, and now they end with no texts, and there's basically been no communication, maybe some sex in between, but none of this serious stuff that goes into making a relationship that's, you know, that's going to last for decades. So, I wonder about the future of marriage, period, you know, and with the future of marriage, you know, then if you take a long historian's view with the future of marriage being on the rocks, then the future of you know, the decline in birth rates, which we're already seeing in all first world nations, and now most of the Asian nations are starting to get even worse. You know, you're really talking about a major revamping of society as we know it or knew it, with, you know, without really much of a roadmap as to where this all leads. Because we're breaking down all the conventional mores and really not a whole lot of springing up to replace them.
Yeah, that's disturbing, isn't it, Brad? If you had a crystal ball, what are some of the directions that you think that this might lead, the roads and where it might lead all of this?
Well, we've talked mainly about the millennials. We threw in a little bit about Generation Z. You know, where it may lead is exactly where it's leading for my generation, which is called the gray divorces. When boomers,
yes,
baby boomers start divorcing, then you've got a whole new phenomenon, which is, you know, marriages that have been stable for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years that should be the bedrock about, you know, which you can really be the dependable part of society. I mean, you don't expect those to blow up. And yet the fastest growing component of divorces are actually amongst the aging boomers. And they call them gray divorces because they're, you know, people with graying or silver hair.
Right.
That is the single fastest growing component of divorce in our society. Uh-huh. I mean, divorce is kind of plateaued for some of the other generations. And actually, gray divorces are now, it has doubled since the divorce rate amongst people over 50 has doubled since 1990. One in four people ages 59 and older has been married two or more times. And Match.com says that people over 50 are the fastest growing age group using its site. So,
yes.
So instead of reaching a stage where you're, you know, 65 years old and you think, you know, okay, I just want somebody to, you know, have my depends available when I need them, you know, to you know, at least know that I've got somebody to drive me to my doctor's appointment, you know, who's somebody who can, you know, help me with my bad back, whatever, which used to be the benchmarks of turning 65. Now it's like, holy shit, maybe I've got 15, 20 more years left, and I'm used to having everything go my way in life so far because I'm a spoiled brat baby boomer to begin with. And you know, bear in mind, the baby boomers may have had the best of all. We got the best of the economy. We got the best of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We got it all
as far as things breaking down our way. I think that that's true. When I read about current events, and including your book and your updates on it, and I look around at some of the struggles that millennials are facing, I think, oh, I'm so glad I was. I mean, I don't necessarily like being an older woman now, but I just feel like I got the best of all worlds as I was growing up.
I think a lot of us feel that way, and in fact, in fact, a lot of us did. I mean,
when
you think about, you know, those of us who are, you know, 50, 60 now, you know, the baby boomers, essentially, you know, we came of age just after World War II when, you know, America was the big dog on the block when you think about it. You know, Russia had 300 million people dead. Europe has been a disaster. We had the Marshall Plan slowly rebuilding Europe. Japan had been nuked. You know, Korea's was flattened from the Korean War. I mean, we were the only viable economic nation, really a major nation that was still in play. And we were exporting all of our goods to everybody else. We weren't importing a bunch of stuff from China. We were exporting everything, and we were making all the money. And everybody grew up and got a job right out of college. And you were able to buy a house. And you know, I mean, it was boom times, baby boom times. So
yeah.
That's translated into an era of and then we had the '60s, which was you know, ain't life grand, and we can live counterculturally if we want, and we can do all. And then we turned into a nation of shoppers during the 80s and 90s. We turned into consumers. Then we got Amazon, and now we can have everything delivered to our doorstep. I mean, it's just we've had everything go our way for a long time, and now that has led to a mentality where the expectation is, you know, why stop now? So I'm 65, you know, maybe the next 15, 20 years, I want to have, you know, a second or third or fourth marriage, that the expectations of the boomers have been kind of off the charts for a long time and maybe a little self-centered. And, you know, and so now you get people that are actually, divorcing in their mid-60s, thinking that there's something better ahead, whereas it used to be that you turned 65 and it was just, you know, all you were doing was writing the, you know, you were composing your epitaph or you know, trying to figure out what you wanted on your tombstone.
Yeah,
exactly. And now it's like, oh, I've still got plenty of time. Why shouldn't I have another marriage or another relationship? And not that necessarily the boomers are going to they're not necessarily going to turn around and get remarried right away. But they are certainly going to launch into more relationships, and
a big component of that is that more older boomers are staying healthy, and then that means that their sexuality is healthier too. If a man is healthy and exercises, even if he's close to 80, he won't necessarily have erectile dysfunction. If he's healthy.
And if he does, he's got Viagra. So, yeah, I mean, the combination of technology and geriatric breakthroughs are huge. Couple that with the expectations that a lot of boomers have got, and, you know, it's like, you know, why should we stop now? Everything's gone our way before and this far. Why shouldn't we want our expectations to match up further? And that's a really obvious phenomena now, with the boomers and the gray divorces being the fastest growing component of divorce at any rate component of society. It's amazing. It really is amazing.
So I know that you've had lots of gray divorce cases in your office.
Yes.
Yes. And it's usually much easier on the man from a financial point of view than it is on the woman, usually. Is that correct?
Well, from the, you know, financially, it's been tracked that guys oftentimes come out of divorces better than women do. I mean, that's pretty well known. Mm-hmm. Kind of sexist, but pretty well known.
Right.
And I should, when I talk about, you know, jumping into new relationships, I should point out there's a difference between men and women on that score, too. A lot of times women of a certain age are not interested in new relationships with new guys. They're sick of having to do all the heavy lifting in relationships, which women oftentimes do. And they're much more attuned to hanging out with their girlfriends than they are jumping into some new relationship. You know, for guys, it's oftentimes, well, there must be some younger woman out there somewhere that can keep me excited or whatever. And, you know, guys will maybe jump into new heterosexual relationships. And I'm not saying that women are going homosexual, but they're just girls groups. I mean, it's not a sexual thing, period, a lot of the time.
And, you know, and some older women do go homosexual. Betty Friedan talked about this 25 years ago more in her book, The Fountain of Age. She said, close to 30 years ago the book was published, she said that some older women, where they've been heterosexual their whole lives, will find another older woman and they'll be sexual together.
They'll have
a relationship, and they get their sexual needs met that way. Now, a woman has to be fairly open, but, you know, more women are more fluid about their sexuality than men. They can be turned on, and this is shown in research, they can be turned on by watching two women have sex. They can be turned on by watching bonobos, the sexual monkeys, make love, not war, having sex. Yeah. They can be turned on by gay men watching sex. I mean, gay men having sex. So women's sexuality is more fluid, but that is a solution for some older women.
And well, you may know more about how it pans out, you know, sexually, but I can tell you that most of when I get a guy divorced who's 50 or even 60 years old, he will oftentimes be out looking for a new, young, oftentimes younger woman, and he'll oftentimes be remarried, you know, within 3 years. I think it's the statistic. If I get a Wahine getting divorced at age 50, the first thing she says to me is, "I'll never get married again as long as I live." So it's a whole different mindset that comes out of these late life divorces with women than it is for men.
A lot of women will say, "So many of the men I meet want a nurse with a purse."
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, and the women want no part of it. That's why you see a lot of older women traveling together. And anyway, I'm glad I'm not one of those older women. I think I enjoy sex too much, and especially
sex with my husband. I think sexuality is too important in your life for it to work that way. But
yeah.
But you're right. I mean, you know, women have always had more close relationships with their own gender than guys have. I mean, what happens?
Yeah.
You know, women have got everything from book clubs to junior league to, you know, to their yoga group or whatever, and they become their best friends. Oftentimes, women will become best friends with their daughters. And there's been research done on that, whereas a wife stays a guy's closest companion, you know, forever, basically, if it's a good marriage. A lot of times, women's closest companion, the guy, will begin taking second place to the wife's to a daughter if she's got a daughter, or even grandkids. Become more of a priority than the aging husband who's needy and whatever, and you know he's around 24 hours a day, whereas he used to be going off to work, and at least you got him out of your hair. So that's why a lot of these things shift the way they do.
That's right. The woman saying to her husband, her retired husband, over breakfast or over lunch, "I married you for better or for worse, but not for lunch every day."
That's right. Go get a second job.
Too much togetherness. So, Brad, we're going to do a part two. I suggested September 18th. Does that work for you?
I am in there on September 18th. And anybody who's listening now, please tune in on September 18th. We're going to do another one on life's changes, which will be big decisions in life, and it may be kind of an interesting one.
It will be, Brad, because it's you. Thanks so much, Brad Coates, for another fascinating hour together on Love, Lust, and Laughter.
Aloha,
goodbye,
everybody.
Happy feet. Da-da-da, happy feet. Da-da-da, happy feet. Oh, I love it.
Love it.
Happy feet.